You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
I would like to, first of all, thank you all for coming, and most importantly, to welcome Nitya Rao for a seminar towards a gender-just transformatory policy, assets, agency, and the structures of governance.
Thanks very much, Sarah. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've done, as Sarah said, some work with UNRIST over the last 10 years or so, particularly for the 2005 Striving for a Just World report. I wrote one of the background papers along with a colleague of mine, Cecil Jackson, also the School of International Development. So it's indeed a pleasure to actually be here. I haven't been in the UNRIST office before. Today I'm going to talk about really assets, agency, and the links with policy. And this is something which I've been thinking about and researching and working with for quite a long time, for about, more than 20 years, I think. As Sarah said, I started off working in 1985 with SEWA, which is the Self-Employed Women's Association. It's a trade union, actually, of women workers. And I worked with them for about 6 years, basically as a grassroots activist, organizing women for a better deal, for getting regular wages, for... It became very clear, I think, during that six-year period, even though SEWA was focusing on economic assets and economic empowerment, that when you start working with women at the grassroots, actually their lives are quite... It's very difficult to separate the economic from the social. Very much part of it was issues of children, of health, of education, of scholarships, of childcare, trying to keep these separate and focusing on one as separate from the other was really very difficult. And I think this was a lesson, actually, which has sort of stayed with me also in research, even though I focused a lot on productive assets, particularly land and economic empowerment, also to some extent employment. But I think the whole issue of the links in women's lives at the grassroots and the difficulty of making this distinction is very strong. What keeps coming up again and again when you talk to women is really that they want to be, recognized. They want to be seen as equals. They want to be seen as persons. It doesn't matter whether they're producing or looking after the children, but they're also equal citizens, equal persons. And I think this comes out very strongly. The link, I think. So thinking about today's topic, I think we have India and most countries, I think from 1975 onwards, really the Mexico conference was quite landmark in this, in terms of highlighting the International Women's Year and women's issues and women's exclusion from development processes. And I think thereafter, and India no exception, that policy framework started giving attention to this. I think after the signing of CEDAW in 1979, and particularly from 1980s onwards, we have a lot of emphasis on women's productive role, women's engagement with development. This was part of the whole women in development discourse. And I think sort of the three key areas, which are also mentioned in the Indian sixth five-year plan, which was from 1980 to 85, so around this period, was in terms of land titles, joint titles, was in terms of also credit, institutional credit, access to credit, and employment for women. If we look what has happened now, more than 30 years on, in 2011, I think the FAO produced the State of Food and Agriculture. The report was focused, their annual report was focused on women and development. And if you look at various countries, we have at most, it's between 10-11% is what in terms of land or land titles that women have a share. And 1980, of course, in Copenhagen was when the famous statement in the UN that, only 1% of assets are owned by women. But in 30 years, it has moved from 1% to 10%. It has changed, but not drastically for all the attention that has been focused on it. Credit is actually institutional credit even worse. These are figures only for India. I could not get for global figures. But from my own research in India, if you look at mainstream institutional credit, despite everything, for farmers, for in the rural context, subsidized credit, actually women are only having about 2 to 4% share, especially of agricultural credit. And the way it's justified is that through microfinance, that all of microfinance is going to women. But of course, this is still a small percentage of total institutional credit that goes out. employment sector has been the most worrying, because actually we see a decline here in terms of decent work opportunities, both in terms of quality and in terms of earnings. And I remember in 1985 when I started working with Seva, the sort of daily wage, it was of course a piece rate wage. I was working with women who rolled bidis, that's a handmade cigarette. It used to be about 10 rupees per day. 10 rupees is, I don't know in euros how much, but maybe about 10, 15 pence in British currency. And we were struggling for getting higher wages, better wages at that time. And recently, 2009-10, when I was doing research in India, I found that the way globalization has taken place and the informalization of the economy, that women whom I interviewed, both in North India and in South India, were getting about the same. And I was really shocked, about 10 rupees per day. And of course, there has been inflation, cost of living has gone up, cost of products has gone up. So if you see it in relative terms, it's actually worth about maybe 10% of what they were getting in 1980. So things have really gone bad as far as employment is concerned. I think we often assume within policy and all the policy statements that give women productive assets, give them access to credit, give them access to land, and then your food security, well-being problems will be solved, almost as a linear kind of a thing. And these were women actually in the area where I worked in Eastern India. They have land, they are all cultivating, but all the children are very severely malnourished. So just having that land is not really leading to improved nutrition necessarily. And I think we know this from research, that there are several issues which mediate access, both physical access as well as social access to resources. And it's not just having the land or having the credit which is going to directly translate into food security. At the center then of what I'm arguing is that actually women's struggles, or women, what they're actually seeking is, of course, well-being, some minimum quality of life and standard of living, but also a recognition of who they are. And assets are important, of course, of different kinds of assets. The ability to use those assets, what has been called as agency, but also the larger context. What is the policy context? Is it enabling? Is it not enabling? How are these actually implemented in practice? The shift in one, and these linkages are not kind of straightforward, unidirectional, because shifts in one do lead to shifts in the other, but often in unpredictable directions. For instance, we have examples of giving assets to women, microfinance. I think a lot of examples coming out of South Asia now, that you give women access to credit. Actually, yes, they do feel a sense that they have credit, they have an asset, but it has also led to increase in violence. It has also led to increase in investments into male assets and into male enterprise. In Bangladesh, India, Grameen Bank, a lot of these recent spurt of research is actually showing that the direction in which the impact of this is not necessarily predictable. It can go either way. It can empower, but it can also lead to further subordination. I want to unpack each of these a little bit before I give you a very concrete example. I think assets, again, there's some gap, I think, here between research and policy, because I think in research, at least in the last 10 years, it has come to be acknowledged that they have multiple meanings, assets have a social value, a social meaning, and also that the range of assets, not only physical assets, but social capital, cultural capital, these are also assets. But I think we still continue to understand them very much in terms of their material values, the economic values, and the material outcomes that they have. It looks very much at assets as an individual, sort of individual relationship, as a subject-object thing, that if you have a land title, then you have control over that asset. And I think making that assumption is also a mistake, because, of course, people are not individuals, but they are socially located in relationships with different people. And each of these assets, in particular land, has very strong social meanings as well, in terms of their status, in terms of identity, in their positionality, their ability to access other resources. So compartmentalizing the economic and the social doesn't necessarily work in practice. But this is the way, I think, in policy, it's very hard to look at each asset at the same time, simultaneously as having an economic value, meaning, but also a social value and a meaning. And that's why negotiation gets that much more complex. I think the third thing, as I already said, is that men and women are often seen as separate categories rather than as having shared lives or living in households with cooperating with each other. The only additional point I think that I want to make is that a lot of grassroots work, I think field work, and this comes out from the women's movement very strongly, is that what women are also looking in terms of, are thinking of in terms of assets is not only physical assets, but also the whole issue of respect and self-worth and self-esteem. So a lot of the empowerment-related programs actually focus on this in terms of building up women's women's self-worth. But of course, this is a relational concept. I can have self-worth, but I need to be recognized by somebody else actually for that to come into fruition. So I think the framework really needs to be socially embedded in looking at assets, that these are not individual things, that this is something which I own and I can do what I like with it. But what I do with it is very much related to the context and the society in which I live. I think as far as agency is concerned, we still think, in at least in terms of policy, that either you're empowered or you're not. Either you're a victim or your agent. It's kind of polarized discourse. And I think, again, research has been pointing out that it's not necessarily that polarized. But I think especially with discussions of agency, a very good example is the demographic health surveys, that it gets reduced to particular characteristics like decision-making ability. And then there are certain indicators for decision-making. And then you say that either you take the decision or you don't take the decision. Similarly about mobility. There are attributes then of what it is to be an empowered woman. And I think typically it is, you know, somebody who's going out and working, somebody and not staying at home looking after children, somebody who's outspoken, able to speak, rather than, you know, being silent. So the idea of sort of an assertive modern, you know, what comes with modernity, some of the characteristics of being an assertive person is really what gets combined with an empowered woman. So then where we start, the starting point for both state policy but also for NGOs is from deficits. That what is it that women don't have? They don't have knowledge, they're illiterate, they're poor, you know, often they're treated in very kind of as if they don't have any knowledge either. And I was hearing somebody, a colleague from Durham, who was presenting a seminar on Nepal and the Tamangs in the mountain areas of Nepal, who said that actually these are now two completely different. They don't engage in terms of cosmologies. They have their indigenous ways of thinking. And then you have the state body of knowledge. And they've reached a stage where they don't engage with the state at all, even though there's state provision, because their point is that the state treats us as subhumans. They don't give us any respect. They treat you as if you don't know anything. And this is not acceptable. We'd much rather live our own lives with respect rather than engaging with this kind of a thing. So I think the important thing is that when we think of agency, I think what I have learned is to start from where women are, from their everyday lives. You know, whether a woman is a leader or not, I haven't seen any woman who doesn't exercise some kind of agency, or any person rather. They do act, they have everyday struggles, even just for negotiating survival now. They have to be very innovative and creative in kinds of the strategies they use. I think start with positive constructions of this. And I think the continuum, that it's not a black and white, that either you don't have agency or you have agency, but it's really a continuum. And how we exercise or assert ourselves in different domains, I think, is important. In terms of policies, I think it's quite right that sometimes when we are dealing with social norms, especially patriarchal social norms, which are hindering progress, which are sort of constraining women, then you have to have a top-down, you have to have an alternative approach. And policies, rules, laws, this is where they come from. They come from global advocacy. They come from the top. And that's fine. But I think what happens is that at the national level, at the nation state level, these become statutes, they become law, but they are very much being defined by the patriarchal state, and they are not reflecting in changes in institutional behaviors, even of the bureaucracy, for instance. I know an example when I was working in Eastern India in the mid-90s that the government passed an order that following the plan, the eighth plan, that all houses, house plots should be given to women. So they said that the house plots will be given and registered in women's names. And of course, when these petty bureaucrats came there, they felt very uncomfortable, mostly men, they felt very uncomfortable talking to the women. So then they would find their husbands and speak to the husbands that we want to give this house plot to the woman. And women really objected to me. I was staying in the village. And they said, no, we have no problem. There's no seclusion. There's nothing. We don't mind talking to these guys. But they just refuse to talk to us. They prefer to talk with the men. So again, you bring in the sort of patriarchal systems that even though you have equal rights in law, but the way it's practiced really destroys the purpose of it. And the final thing about policy, I think, is also gender equality policies go in sort of one direction, but you have all the other policies, the labor policies particularly, and the employment-related policies, which are pulling in a completely different direction. And I think this has become a very great problem. Just to give a very small example from work I did in Bangladesh, that the Bangladesh government has very pro-girls education policy where they are giving secondary school stipends and so on for girls to go to school. This is fantastic. But the labor policy basically says that the export-oriented garment sectors, at the age of 14, you can join workforce and you need a minimum 8th grade certificate. So on the one hand, you have an education policy saying complete high school. On the other hand, your employment policy saying all that you need is an 8th grade to actually get employment. So I think this kind of contradiction and the choices that are imposed, there's lack of consistency there. And again, I think one would start with what is seen as legitimate on the ground. And I think there are many things which I'll demonstrate in my example, which are seen as legitimate on the ground. And can we start with that? But also very important is the mechanisms for accountability, transparency, and so on. So it's good to have the laws, but what are the mechanisms available there? And again, I think women tend to get pushed out of most decision-making mechanisms across countries. Again, an example from Bangladesh, I was doing work with the education sector and the school management committees. In Bangladesh, the parents are members of that, but a parent or a guardian is defined as the father legally. So in the school management committee, it was only the fathers who could be the representatives of the parents. The teachers, the principals and so on felt that the mothers are very important for the children's education. They are the ones who are there. We need to get them involved. So how to do it? Have then some informal group, mothers club, where you get the mothers completely to do voluntary work, come help their children, but actually no say in the decision-making body, which is the SMC, which is the legally legitimate space. So I think this kind of a problem in terms of legitimacy and in terms of mechanisms is something we need to give thought to. Okay, I wanted to give the case of land, which is where I have been working quite a lot, and look at Asia, and just to give a little bit of the background of Asia, of course, 60% of the world's population, 30% of the arable land, so majority are smallholder cultivators. I think, again, despite the legal and policy equality, only 10% of women. And I think there are three things, general points to make. One is that it's not been unchanging. There have been changes because of technology, because of migration, because of many other things in terms of land use and ownership patterns. The other thing is that apart from the idea of the male head of household, all over Asia, this notion of the Asian values of the family are very strong, and therefore the family is seen as the unit, and it becomes very difficult for states particularly. They have internalized it so much, and they all programs and so on, and I'll illustrate that. But also, I think it's important that there's no linear relationship between assets and access to assets, work, employment, land, and actually gender equality. Because two of the countries' examples, which I will take, China and India, actually both have economic participation, very good laws, legal equality, but both have very skewed sex ratios. In India, the latest 2011 census shows that child sex ratios have actually further declined. So it's quite a serious problem here. So going back to this, I think what I wanted to argue is that even looking just at assets agency and the policy framework, we can't really understand it without locating these assets within the wider context of livelihoods. Agency within the social relations, the kinship structures, and policy within sort of legitimacy, what is seen as legitimate, both legally as well as socially and morally. Okay, China, I think I'll go very quickly through the cases because I'm a little bit short of time. But of course, if anybody has questions, I can explain further. So 1949, of course, private property was abolished and legal, it became, land became a state subject. There was state control. Pre and post-production services are provided under by state control. Last 20, 30 years, there has been rapid urbanization and migration. I think started off with male migration. More recently, in the last 5, 10 years, a lot of younger women have been migrating too. But given the registration system, household registration system, urban registration is still very difficult, I believe. And so when men move, married, the wives and children normally tend to stay back in rural areas. In terms of social relations, I think it's very interesting that some of the studies that are coming out of China, that there is still, it has to some extent been changed after 1998 and the rural land contracting law. But till then, there were different shares. Even though state was allocating, it was allocating different shares to sons and daughters. Because the assumption was that after marriage, the daughter will move to the husband's place. And of course, women do receive shares from their husbands, especially when they migrate. For women who get separated, I think recent research in China is showing it's been very difficult. They can't go back to their natal home and get the share there. But at the same time, their marital home, if they separate, it becomes very difficult to stay on there. Even though the national law assures equality, the decision about land allocation is taken by the village-level decision-making body. There's often a conflict between the village rules because they have to decide by two-thirds majority to whom they allocate land. And for separated women in particular, since these decision-making bodies largely exclude women, I think they feel that this is not an appropriate status. They are some sort of deviants, and this is not an appropriate status. They don't get allocated land. And very interestingly, I think despite the fact that China gives sort of pre and post-production services, it recognizes women and it gives them, but titles tend to be still in male names. Even in China, it's only 10% women who actually have land titles. And now, with the recent period of appropriation of land for industrialization and other purposes, the women are denied compensation. And in fact, now women have started mobilizing there to demand pensions rather than compensation for land, universal social pensions. Okay. So if you look at the whole thing together, I think it helps us understand that while there are supports, there are lots of contradictions. And when we look at why then has this policy of equality not translated, I think one can start identifying contradictions and areas where these might be actually clashing, including in terms of state policies. India is very different from China. It's mainly private inherited land, very little state land. There's large-scale male out-migration, and the rural areas have been feminized. I think majority is women, but they are not recognized, unlike in China, even for production support, for infrastructure, for services. There is no kind of attention to women. The example that I just gave, these petty bureaucrats, they come, they still prefer to talk to the man, even if he's absent from there. And this dependence on low-paid informal sector work, I think, has been something. Of course, a patrilineal system which denies women rights. We have recently had a change to the law, the Hindu Succession Act, which affects 80% of the population to give equal inheritance rights to sons and daughters. But at the same time, very few women are actually claiming this. We have quotas in local government for women, but they're excluded from all other decision-making bodies. I think the interesting thing about India is that women's voice or agency, it shifts with life cycle. I think as you grow older, age hierarchy seems to work. Also, women who have sons, I think, and become mothers-in-law, they get a better status, much greater mobility, greater voice. So it's not also the same for all women. And especially in terms of legitimacy, if we see, and this kind of plays out even in policy, very clear life cycle distinctions in terms of, you know, widows are seen as socially legitimate, single women completely no-no if you're a separated or a divorced woman. Even in urban educated, in Delhi, which is the capital of India, you know, a separated woman will find it very hard to get a house on rent. Nobody wants to give it. You're seen as some kind of an odd person. So I think the failure to recognize, even by the state, entitlements despite joint titles. Okay, and this is just again from my fieldwork. I don't know if they are clear at all or not. But the first is about lack of water and sanitation. They still go to the collective place. And this is where women have claimed. This is a court. But the power dynamics there are quite interesting, that, you know, the lawyers and others, they do talk to the men, either seat them on the chairs or stand and talk, but the women are always on the ground. Okay. And very quickly, Indonesia, which is a very different kind of a state, with especially the Suharto's New Order regime and so on, it was very much focused on family values. Land is controlled by private smallholders. Both men and women migrate. I think labor here has been very equal and has been the basis for entitlements. Men more internally, and Indonesian women now more in the transnational care market for domestic work. The kinship pattern in Indonesia is matrilineal and bilineal, so women and men do both inherit. And the last point I will just talk about a little bit more, actually, in terms of what's happening with the markets, is actually introducing gender inequality. And I think this is something to point of worry. But in terms of legitimacy, despite this, at community level equality in terms of inheritance, in terms of recognizing labor contributions, the state has very much pushed this notion of the family. And male head of household is given precedence in resource allocation. Separated women are face difficulties and so on. Okay, I think just to look back then to this thing of giving women assets and expecting it to lead to food security. As I said, there are lots of other things that intervene. Markets is one. Domestic work, unpaid work particularly. And this picture is interesting, that this is fodder, but these are quite prosperous in northern India, in the Green Revolution belt. They have material. It's not that they don't have money. The front part of the houses are very well done with living room furniture, TVs, motorcycles, cars. But you enter inside, and the kitchen is all, the women's domain is all kind of hand grinding, no mixer grinder, you know, cooking on fuel wood and so on. So I think there's a real kind of mismatch in terms of status considerations, that all the expenses, the expenditures are done on kind of male status goods, and the female domain is completely neglected. I think markets play a very important role. What are the market signals? And again, this is at a very low level in a poor area in eastern India, that when women come to sell, of course, it is the men who have storage, who have transportation, who can dominate the prices. Even where women are sellers, they're selling to other poor women, and it's sort of very small, low-value products from which they can make some money. It is not really a source of great opportunity that they face in terms of local markets. But coming back to the Indonesian case, I think from 2007-08, when we had the global food crisis and the panic around that, there was this whole thing which has been called as land grabs, that you have to have commercialization, both foreign and domestic investors, to get into contract farming as the only way to raise food production and therefore lead to solve this global food crisis. And I think this has been argued by several people, including Deininger and others at the World Bank, that contract farming is the way ahead. This is, of course, not so straightforward, because it is embedded in unequal power relations between the contractors, the investors, and wanted to give one example. There's not much gendered research at all on what is happening with land grabs. But there was an interesting paper from Indonesia, that where land has been taken over for the oil palm plantations. First of all, it abolishes the customary rights, not only to the private and common lands, but also to forest. And for women, I think this is something that I've seen in India and argued as well, that land is a continuum in itself. I think they use agricultural land, common land, forest land in different ways to contribute to their livelihoods. Here, rattan baskets and so on was something which they were producing, which has now been denied. When new land is allocated, the Indonesian government's policy has been very much that land titling should be in male names. Women are excluded also from compensation payments. In the oil palm plantations, the men get the jobs as the drivers, the security, you know, all the regular jobs. which is not surprising. And the women actually get the insecure, low-paid jobs, including spraying pesticides, applying fertilizers, without any kind of protective gear, quite hazardous in many ways. Where they have some land, they are the ones who are continuing with rice production, with paddy cultivation. Earlier, this was a joint activity. Now, under the Dayak custom, and this refers to the ethnic group of the Dayaks, that selling rice is taboo. It's a food item. So rice production is completely for consumption. So women get blocked into also producing for consumption for the home. They don't have an extra source of income. And ultimately, what it is leading to is that anything which is voluntary, unpaid, becomes women's work. So it's quite a shift in the reverse direction in the case of Indonesia, where earlier their labor contributions were valued. The women themselves say that they do benefit from male cash earnings in terms of investing in education, health, better food, and so on. But it has also led to the growth of cafes and prostitution, where men have excess money to spend. So there have also been other ways, because women have lost out their forest and extra cash earning ability, there are other ways which are not necessarily safe to earn. I think this whole issue of liquor and prostitution selling, is this becoming the only option which gets women a decent wage? Because any other kind of employment is not getting them a decent wage. So just what does this tell us? What do these tell us? I think we do have legal equality. And I think from a policy perspective, they see that patriarchy is the barrier, or social norms are seen as the barrier. There's always this opposition that state policy is great and social norms are the problem. But of course, this, as I've just demonstrated, that state policy also, there are so many inconsistencies in terms of titling, in terms of male names, in terms of their institutional practices. So it's not, and they reinforce some of these customary social norms. In the case of Indonesia, where there was much greater equality, actually the state policy and the market policies are leading to new forms of gender inequality. I think the diversity of household structures, which even the state doesn't recognize, I think for single women is a real problem. And in India now, the last 10 years, there's a great movement of NGOs trying to organize single women to actually claim an identity as households, that single women households are households. And this is not some kind of an oddity, given that today almost 20 to 30% are female-headed households in many ways. So one of the issues that does come up very much from a lot of this discussion is that what is seen as legitimate is share in marital land, or marital property. Because in a lot of the Asian countries, which tend to be patrilineal, the exception of Indonesia, patrilocal, China, India, that women move after marriage to their husband's residence, they try to establish their identity and belongingness there. And I think there's a very strong claim that we need a recognition of equal shares of marital property. And this is not something that is somehow easily getting picked up by state policy. The focus very much is on inheritance of parental share. The whole issue of partnership and conjugal relations, of having distinct but complementary interests as in Indonesia, and the social valuation of work, is reproductive and productive work seen in equally or valued equally or not? Because this is very central both to personal worth and, of course, to the household economy. And I know UNRIS has done a lot of work on the care economy and as a very central element of the macro economy. When we look at agency, then, I think it is really about identity. And I think here I want to emphasize it's about bodies, both laboring bodies as well as reproductive bodies and sexual bodies. But it's also about intellect. I think this is something that women feel a lot. That they're somehow seen as unthinking, non-thinking people, but that they also have thoughts, they also have ideas, they also have aspirations. I think this is not something that we easily recognize. And from some of the recent work that I've been doing on this, especially in terms of intra-household decision-making on a recent research project, that how do people really think about decisions? Not the way that the DHS does, but they really break it down into different kinds of decisions you have in the productive, reproductive decisions. And I think it's very interesting that in North India, in Nepal, a very large part of household expenditure is actually going on education of children. This is seen as a big priority for the future security. In some cases, almost 50% of household income. And this is somehow seen to be in women's domain. And I've seen women, even if they're not earning, saying that, no, we have to send our child to a private school or to private tutoring. And actually, the husband does agree and give in. So I think how we think about decisions, do we necessarily devalue these decisions and give only weightage to the productive decisions or not. The complexity in terms of the process itself. I think the other thing which I said, especially in South Asia, that it's very much linked to women's subject position, which is her stage in the life cycle, age, marital status, number of children she has, educational level, and so on. That as she grows older, and particularly if she has sons, I think she has much greater voice in terms of taking decisions. But it's also linked very much to gender interests. And I think we come across this many times in the case of land. I have seen women who have actually supported their husbands when the sister has tried to stake a claim in land because of this legal equality. The wife supports her husband and her children rather than his sister. So even though they are two women, but there's not necessarily automatic solidarity because they're in very different positions in terms of their gender interest. And of course, this is responding to changes in context, especially migration. And I think there's some, later on, if I have time, I can tell you a little bit more about how, I'm going to wrap up. Another 2 minutes, maybe. This does change. Okay, so I think those were really the main points. There is a need, of course, for collective action and collective voice in terms of changing institutional norms and so on. And I think we can come back to some of that if needed. But I think the key principles for me is to start with women's lives and, you know, what they think as important, what the meanings in terms of assets. The linkages with the wider environment. I think the circle, my conceptual frame is just thinking of women as individuals is not really helpful in thinking about this issue, both of policy change and especially in relation to land. One needs to think of the larger context from the micro to the macro within which they are embedded. Okay, and I think I've gone through that and also to recognize that there are new strategies in response to context. Contextual changes that women are adopting. So I just want to finish, just leave you with a picture actually. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we've got, good 40 minutes or so for questions and discussion. So thank you, Lucia, for I think quite a wide-ranging presentation, which gives us a sense of some of the key issues that have been on the agenda, I think, going back to the starting point, the 1980s, the 1970s, and way back before then. And pointing, there are sort of policy changes. There are some changes on the ground. There doesn't seem to be that much that's different, actually. I kind of felt it would have been nice to have some of, because I know you've done so much rich field work, to sort of get a little bit more of a sense of where do you see, you know, some of the real shifts, impacts of different policy changes or impacts of social movements from the bottom on policy, etc. But anyway, let's open it up to the floor. I'm sure I'll come back with, I have more, many more questions, but let me open up to a few comments for Lisa and then Peter.
Yes, thank you very much for this really, really nice overview. I have the paper and I've already marked things that I have to read, so that's always really good to have. I think you made a statement in the middle of the presentation, and it's also in the paper, which actually, if I think about it, is quite outrageous. And the statement is that there is no relationship between land ownership and gender equality. And I have two questions about that. The first question is, I'm not sure I quite understood that, but I understood it correctly. So I'd just like you to slowly go over that again.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Because you also said that you know, that the titles in China are in the names of men. So what does that mean, that to begin with there is some kind of equality around land in China, yet the titles are in the
names? I can explain that.
Can you explain
that
again?
Sure.
And then second, so if that really is correct, that there is no relationship between land ownership, who owns the land, and gender equality, I'm just wondering, you know, what does that do with regard to policy? In a way, would you go so far to say that this whole idea to move towards joint titles and things of that nature is entirely misguided? No. Okay. No.
I'll clarify that.
Yeah, but.
Okay. Should I just take two or three questions?
Yeah, that's
and then
fine.
Come back to you, and then Peter, and then Patsy.
Thank you, Nikki. That was fascinating. When looking at India in relation to the other countries, I mean, one thing that you talked about India is the point you raised at the end is just the level of collective organization of women and the women's self-help movement, the forestry initiative, and the social movement. We just saw last month with Hector Parishad, 50,000 tribal people making women marching in Delhi and the government of India wearing reform legislation. And so India seems to stand out in that regard. It's very interesting things happening in terms of collective organization and voice. I was just wondering if you could, how much importance should do we attach to that? How significant is that?
Yeah, also thank you very much for the presentation.
Maybe if you can speak up or stand up.
I have one question which is a little bit related to the first question. You mentioned on several occasions that that there were kind of legal changes and policy changes, but you also emphasized a lot that there are kind of social barriers, social norms, social culture and relations that influence very much really the kind of voice, identity, power of women, etc. So my question is, and that leads a little bit to Elizabeth's question, how do you see how, let's say, on the one hand, what can women do actually maybe to work on these both fronts in terms of the social norms, that type of kind of recognition of the identity and so on, and what can they do with regard to the policy changes? And I had the impression that from your presentation that you kind of consider maybe these social relations even more powerful or more in the long term or more influential than the policy changes. So what to do with that in a way? How can policy then influence on these social norms? And the second, very quickly, you presented the three country cases and kind of a lot of kind of similarities came up with regard to this gap between, let's say, legal entitlements, policies, and the actual power structures on the ground. So I would ask you, where do you see other differences? Because these are obviously, especially looking at the social and cultural norms, very, very different cases. So what type of lessons or, you know, specific insights you have drawn from this comparative research?
Okay.
Should I give you a few minutes to respond?
Yeah.
And I think there'll be more questions.
Okay, I think to start with yours, I think it is related to what Katya said as well. I don't think I meant no relationship between land ownership and gender equality. It's just that it's mediated. It's not a direct linear causality between land ownership and gender equality. But there are many other things that have to be part of the process. And I think I didn't mean at all that policies are not important. I said policies are, they have to be somewhere top down. We need an enabling framework. We need a framework of equality. But then how that translates, how that gets legitimized, both socially and legally, becomes very important. So both within policy. So I raise the issue of legitimacy, actually. The policy framework is very important. I have been a great supporter of it. And I would be the last person to say, no, we don't need it, including joint titles. I think joint titles are there. But even then, it has not been internalized. I think this is where I think the issue of social relations, that these state bodies are also socially embedded. I think there's a whole literature around the state society that you have the policies, but they are not disembodied. Both law and state are also socially embedded institutions, and it's the lawyers, the bureaucrats, the practitioners who are part of that society. And I have many examples from my own fieldwork that where women went to claim, the lawyer would refuse to take the case and to advise her. The police do it all the time. If a woman wants to report a case of violence against her husband, the police first counsel her to say, no, you shouldn't break up the family. You should try and adjust somehow. So I think the law is important. But I think we cannot forget that the people who implement policy, the lawmakers, the policymakers, and the implementers, they are also embedded within the same set of social relations and norms which we are trying to break. And I think somehow if we see these as distinct, then it's not helpful, but to change their practice. I think that I have been part of, since 2005, actually part of the collective organizations that Peter mentioned. In fact, I helped set up a network working on women and land rights in 8 states of India. In 2005, as part of the Beijing Plus 10 process, there was a meeting in Delhi, regional meeting, and I was presenting the background paper in South Asia on land, and then we set up this network. They are still working, and part of the strategies, as you see, are very exciting. It is also about training and working with the government functionaries. So in Gujarat, what they have started doing now is that the women are aware. They know that they want these claims to be operationalized. But it is the patwari, who is the land person who keeps the land records, who's the major bottleneck. So they are now going to these camps and trying to tell them that, look, these are the joint titles which are already there. What does this mean? You have to recognize, you have to give this woman also the credit. The issue of the Kisan credit cards or the agricultural credit cards with banks, I think we need to do advocacy. Agricultural credit is based on this, and now in India they have liberalized it, which is much easier, that every time you want an agricultural loan, you don't have to go to the bank, but they issue something called an agricultural credit card. So it's like a credit card, works the same way as a credit card. For 3 years, you can take as much as you need. And this, only about 2% of women, even though 10% of women have land titles, even if titles was a consideration, many more should have had these agricultural credit cards. The banks just refuse. They think that the women are incapable of handling credit. And they say, go for microfinance. I have seen this and I have argued against this. Not that I have anything against microfinance, but where they need larger amounts of credit for agricultural work, microfinance is not sufficient. So I think the point I was trying to make is that, and also in these countries, in India especially, I think I can talk more confidently. The other two countries is through secondary literature review and research, whereas in India I have done primary research, is that the land titles, and gender equality. I think that the people who have land titles are actually, in India, after independence, we had something called, under land reform program, that a maximum ceiling to land, that any household, in order to reduce social inequality in general and redistributive land reform, that households with large land holdings will have to give away some part. There was a maximum limit on how much land you can have. So what of these big landlords? They basically put the land in the women's names. So they subdivided land by giving to each member of their family, their wives, their daughters, etc. So in my field work, what I have found is that the large number of women who have land titles either are not aware that they have the land titles, and even if they are belonging to the wealthy landholding households, where they anyway have seclusion and other practices, they employ labor, they don't go and work on the fields. And where it matters, for the poor, the peasant castes, the smallholders, there this joint titling and this division has not been implemented. In one of the Indian states, Maharashtra, they decided on computerization. And this was very interesting because by default, because we have a law on joint titling, when they computerized the land records, by default, they added the women's names. So if all women have joint titles on the land record once it's been computerized. But again, in terms of practice, the institutional norms, behaviors have not changed. These other constraints to access other resources have not changed. They cannot join the agricultural cooperatives to get subsidized seeds. They have to engage with the markets. And I feel personally that actually social norms and social relations at the household are changing much faster than bureaucratic behaviors of the patriarchal state. I find in North India, which is patriarchal heartland of India, where I did research quite recently, the men are all migrating out for work to Mumbai and other places. The women are at home. They follow seclusion practices. But the way they have changed the norm, that now they are in charge of the farms, they're going to the farms, they're doing everything, but the agricultural cooperative will not take them as members. So what these men have done, and I was very impressed actually, with technology, that they have bank accounts where they're working in Mumbai or Gujarat, and they leave the cash card, the ATM card, with their wives at home. So they deposit the money into their bank account, and the woman can go and take the cash because she has to do everything through the market, since the state cooperatives will not give her seeds and resources. So I find that the attempt by both men and women, especially with the pressures of the larger environment of market forces and liberalization for the poor, and I think that's the other thing that I should have emphasized, I'm mainly focusing on the poor, that actually the households are coming together. I mean, men, there's much greater cooperation, especially in contexts where there's migration, that they do want to build shared and reciprocal lives. So things like, you know, of course, mobile phones as a form of communication, it can work both ways, to subordinate but also to empower. I've seen women's groups, again in UP, using mobile phones in very liberating ways to get access to services, to get access to information and to knowledge, particularly in male absence. So I think these social changes are taking place, and I'm quite hopeful that actually if there's social change from the bottom in India, in terms of the collective pressure, that this will ultimately change the state as well. The state is the one that's proving more resistant to changing its practice. And I think this groundswell of people's mobilization is possibly going to force the state to actually just, because people want it now, they want that equality. So, and the framework is there.
Can I take another few more questions?
Sorry.
Okay. Yep. Sorry, and say your name if you...
My name is Cassidy Travis, and I'm coming from UNEP. And I'm curious actually about the last comment that you made. I think that it's interesting to hear how within the family unit they're kind of trying to adapt some of their strategies to offer within the confines of like society that might not have moved as quickly as they're trying to adjust to these changes. I'm wondering though, in terms of some of the other women that you're talking about, where you have widows or you have separated women, or you know, in a post-conflict context where kind of that social cohesion is falling apart, and you have the disconnect both at the family unit level and then the disconnect at the policy level where it's not translating onto the ground, what kind of strategies or things can be done to address some of those inequities?
I think...
Can I take just a few other other questions?
Yeah.
At the front of the back.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. Yeah, I'm asking a question maybe a little bit not directly related to what you're talking. I realize that your topic is mainly focused on the rural women.
Louder.
Rural women, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would understand the gender equality issues may be more severe in rural areas, but given the faster migration, urbanization process, I'm wondering for the rural women, whether when you study the gender inequality issues, you could kind of also apply the same framework you are using, and what would be the different dynamics, power structures for the urban women, and maybe what's your plan if you want to study this mechanism in urban area, what would be the, is something toxic? Here, for women, women, you use land as an asset, and you talk about how women, urban women.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll come back to you.
Okay, I think, separated and single women and conflict. I think these are the really the vulnerable. I mean, they are the difficult ones because they don't have social legitimacy either. In a lot of Asia, you know, separated women are seen as, it's not acceptable. You're supposed to be committed to your family. I think in India, under Hindu marriage custom, it's like a, you know, lifelong partnership, and even if things are not that great, so I think, and it's always the woman who's blamed for a separation. So I think that is a very difficult thing to change. Also, social acceptability, whether it's in urban or in rural, and I think this is some of the other indigenous groups where I worked in Eastern India, they are with what we call as scheduled tribes or indigenous people. And I think there is much greater marital mobility and much greater acceptance that this is a partnership. So if things aren't working, it's fine to separate, to move on, to get into another marriage. Very progressive in that sense, in terms of marriage. But for a large part of the mainstream society, I think marriage becomes really a binding force and a problem. And I quite agree with you that, you know, this is an area which needs a lot of struggle. I think even the state doesn't recognize, particularly divorced and separated women. I think widows are all right, because widows have been seen to have done their bit. They have done their duty to their husband. They have looked after, they have brought up children and so on. And so they're legitimate, if you like, in terms of claims, making claims and claims making. But it's the separated, the divorced, or those who choose to not get married. I think unmarried single women, this is a real problem. In India now, I think, given that very large numbers, even of urban educated women, don't necessarily want to get married or want to be single mothers or have, you know, their own household type, there's very little legitimacy. And I think there is a movement now. I think in India, the advantage has been that being a democracy, I think, and a freedom of speech and space for people to mobilize and organize. And they've been demanding. It's a slow process. I think it is a bottom-up process. It's a struggle. It's already been about 10 years. I think things are not shifting that much. They're beginning to shift. So I think it is a process of struggle, of bottom-up struggle to get those policy shifts. Even as far as separated women, I think we still need a policy shift to recognize single women also as, you know, valid household types. In terms of rural and urban, I think there are, in rural, of course, my main focus has been on sort of land, in terms of agricultural land. Of course, in urban areas, also space is a problem. I worked, my first work actually was with Seva, which was in an urban context. And I was working with vegetable vendors. I started off actually for some brief period of time with vegetable vendors in Ahmedabad city. And again, the problem of space, any kind of space, of women having claim to that is a problem. So I think as part of this mobilization with this gender and land rights network that we are doing, and also Seva and other organizations have done, is also for access to urban space for women's informal employment, of course, for women's employment activities, for housing. I think housing has been very critical in an urban context for women to have rights to sort of basic housing and facilities. And I think new ideas now in relation to you know, marketing particularly, and I think related to employment and work-related spaces, marketing spaces, I think these are becoming... I haven't recently done too much on that to be able to give you a more detailed answer on that. I'm sorry, I missed out your China question, which you asked. Yeah, shall I do it? To go back to the question on
yeah. Is there any other questions? Yeah, should we take a couple more?
And then yeah, that's fine.
That all together. Yeah, there are a couple more at the back. Yep.
If you would make a kind of interesting research and reach the conclusion that if women in developing countries had ownership of land, this would have a direct impact on agricultural production and on fighting hunger. Now, from what I understand from your presentation, you don't see a very direct link between women land titling for women and increased agricultural production. So you see it much more nuanced.
Hmm.
Could you please elaborate on it?
Yeah.
And one more.
Thank you. My name is Adrienne Stork. I work with UNEP as well. We're working in post-conflict scenarios, especially in looking at issues of women and land and natural resources. My question is, in regarding these types of contexts, you often see a very strong pushback to very traditional norms in post-conflict or post-crisis settings. And this can even push back right against what the norms may have been just prior to the conflict or the crisis, really looking back to almost a much older version of what the traditional norms were. So I'm wondering, in contexts like that, if you've experienced or seen those types of contexts in your research, either in these types of settings or elsewhere, and what sort of thoughts or recommendations you might have for dealing with those. And then also, I'm wondering, when that happens in a particular situation, in an area, say, of a country, and I'm thinking of the example of Aceh in Indonesia in particular, that happens in an area where there's a very strong pushback against women's empowerment, and in this case, even for women who are part of the Free Aceh movement and who are fighting and part of their struggle. You have that, and it's actually going quite against what the state norms might be at the higher level. Then how also can you try to work with that within these different levels of policy and of governance? Thank you.
Okay, I think land titles and production. I think what we have seen is that just land titles, without the extra support, without support, whether it's labor support, inputs, you know, all the other resources that you need, time. So also reducing the drudgery, the other work. So making sure that there's, you know, water provided, other things, so that women can manage both things, I think becomes important. Now, with technically speaking, I think where land titles and there is an awareness and mobilization around land titles, particularly with NGO support, I think there has been a positive impact. So in India, we have in Andhra Pradesh, this is the one example which is quoted often, the Deccan Development Society, which organized poor women, got them land titles, gave them all the support, help them, you know, to engage with markets, with states. I think the mediation with the state was very important, which the Deccan Development Society did. And of course, these women, in 20 years' time, they are empowered, production has improved, they are food secure. But you need all that other package of support. I think a lot of land titles where it has been given to women with the policy as the two types land. In India, the majority of land is private land, which is inherited. There's a small share, which we call as government land or ceiling surplus, which has come out of land reform, which government has to redistribute to poor and vulnerable. And they have a policy, again, from the 8th plan onwards, 1990s, that this land will be redistributed to women. Now, often, when under land reform in India, what has happened is that people who give up land actually give up the worst plots of land. So if I have 100 acres of land and I can only keep 50 acres, then first of all, I get rid or give to the government voluntarily what is the worst, the uplands, the stony land, what often waste, described as waste land. And this then gets redistributed to women. So they get this plot of land, which is very poor quality. And then they have to put in all the effort to actually make it cultivable. And without any extra support, without cash, without resources, it becomes a very hard a task. So that's one. I think the second thing is, so the other resources is one. And the other thing is, of course, labor. When women do have land titles, I think unlike Africa, the African systems are quite different from Asia. In a lot of Asia, especially South Asia, plowing in particular is a male task. And there's a taboo. And it's very interesting that when I actually, especially to all these separated women, I ask them that, okay, you've got a share of land. Why don't you start plowing? And then, you know, this is the major bottleneck because you're not able to get labor for plowing. It's delaying your production and your output is going down. And they said that, no, they can't. There were many different reasons for it. But a lot of the women argued that they themselves had an interest that plowing should remain a male thing because this was the only thing that men were doing. They said, everything else we are doing. Everything government or other things, you know, whether it's self-help groups, whether it's income generation, is targeted on women. And actually, especially with this economic, I think, I keep coming back to that, with the kind of shrinking of employment. In India, for the first time now, 2010-11, the total employment figures have gone down from 1980s onwards. So it's a bad situation for men as well. So men end up doing actually nothing. And the women said to me very clearly that this is the only task that they do. So at least they should feel part of the household. They should feel that they're contributing something. If we take over this, then they will stop doing anything at all. And I think we have data to show that in terms of joint work, in our national sample employment and unemployment surveys, that the category of joint work, men's contribution to joint work has really declined. Whether it is domestic work, whether it is household farming work, they are contributing much less. Majority of joint work, which is also the unpaid work, is being done by women. Men are either migrating out. So I think there are several reasons that why just having the land title, first of all, operationalizing, even I think it's a good thing to have the land title. But then how do you use that land title to get access to various entitlements which are needed, including support for labor? And I think one of the big constraints in rural India and in rural South Asia has been very poor infrastructure in terms of fuel and cooking fuel and water, that collection of drinking water and firewood for cooking are still two very important tasks which have to be done. as a priority. And so that really squeezes out women's labor time. In terms of post-conflict, going back to traditional practices, I think absolutely, I think absolutely you're right about this. And I think this is where I didn't talk about it much, but I think the coherence between different domains of policy becomes very important. I think we have the recent case from Afghanistan of the girl Malala, northern Pakistan actually, who was attacked and shot for arguing for girls' rights to go to school. And of course, in that context, if we look at it, or in Afghanistan, I think interviews with women and so on have shown that it's not that they don't want to send their daughters to school, but the security environment is really bad. And they fear for the lives of their children, especially the girls. And therefore, I think that this, unless we can get over that, the whole dimension of fear and insecurity. And you're absolutely right. And I think this is becoming a new problem in terms of going back to traditional practices. And I'll give you an example which is very recent and very close to home. In the Indian Parliament, there has been recent discussion, again, in North India, in Haryana, which is one of the most progressive states materially. It doesn't have that type of poverty, but the gender equality is the worst. The female sex ratios are the worst in the country. And there have been increasing number of cases of rape and of attacks on girls and young couples, actually, for self-choice. They're trying to control marriage. I think really going back to a very traditional norm, part of the issue is that there are fewer girls than boys. So there's large number of men who are bachelors, who don't have wives. And therefore, each community wants to make sure that their girls remain within their community because there's a shortage of brides. So girls who go to university, to college, they meet other men, maybe from other communities. There have been increasing actually killings of such young couples. There's also been increasing rapes within the last 1 month in Haryana, very close to Delhi, which is the national capital. There have been half a dozen rapes. The women's movement has really taken this up. And what the local, including the local politicians, have said, which is really shocking, is that in order to prevent rapes, we should reduce the age at marriage. So if you let the girls marry at 14, yeah. So then the question of rape is not there, because then she is, you know, soon after puberty, she's then husband's problem. So this is not the way. I mean, this is really a regressive thing. And if you have people at the state legislature level saying that this is the only way to protect girls from rape is to reduce the age at marriage, I think it's a real challenge. So we don't know whether we are going forwards or backwards. And I think in context of conflict, in context of violence, in context of social change, you're absolutely right that you have this coming up of very traditional forces, and we have to, you know, we have to fight against it. But this is where also politics and policy comes in, that, you know, it's in India, it's a democracy. And I think the women's movement has been very strong on this, that it ultimately ends up as a vote bank, you know, for political interests and not necessarily women's interests. Women's interests are the first to be sacrificed for meeting political interests. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but I do agree with the point that you're making, and that we do need to have a much wider policy coherence to actually address the issue of gender.
Go back
on the China.
Or I don't know if there are any last minute burning questions, because this will be the last response. So, okay, so you can have the last word on
it. Yeah, China. I think titles, your question was about. Yeah, I think what is happening is that the land title, this, even I was not very aware, and I haven't done primary field research in China, but from whatever I have researched and read, that in China, actually, the production is organized at the village level, and everybody is allocated an equal share as far as production is concerned, men and women, and they get all the services. So there's no discrimination as far as services is concerned. But actually, the title is going, and after the household registration system, they went back in 1978, the title goes to the household in the name of the household head, who's usually a male. So majority of land that is registered in terms of title, and now with land appropriation for industrialization, what has happened is that whoever has the title is the one who is compensated. So it doesn't affect your agriculture on the ground, because if you are cultivating a plot of land, you get all the services. But if your land is being sold or being taken over, then it is the man who will get the compensation, because legally he's listed in the title. So I think this is kind of the contradiction. There's some other things. 1978 was the household registration. I think in China, between 1949 and 78, it was a commune. 1978, they went back to the household registration. And actually, I should say about marriage law, which goes very closely with the land laws
One
in
minute,
China. Sorry.
Last minute.
Yeah. That they also, the marriage law of 1954 also sort of established that, you know, marriage by choice and so on. It abolished the patrilocal kind of thing. But 1978, when they went back to household registration system, marriage became the only way to again recruit and reproduce labor for households. And so the women became, you know, very important and instrumental in that. And thereafter, there have been changes. So 1998, there was the rural land, mid-80s, actually, rural land contracting law, which was discriminatory because it gave shares to the couple, but in terms of the children in land allocation, and it was for 15 years, for the children, it gave the sons an extra share than the daughters because it said that they will bring in the wives. So they'll have to support the wives. 1998, the land contracting law was changed. They equalized the shares for sons and daughters. But of course, this meant that once the woman married and moved to her husband's place, she didn't really have a share. It could not be changed. It was fixed for 30 years.
I'm going to have to wrap up. Well, thank you. Let me, on behalf of everybody, thank you very much, Nitya, for really responding to a very wide range of questions, for providing a lot of sort of the sense of some of the issues, you know, on the ground as well as at the level of policy frameworks and debates. And thank you.
Thank you.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.